Hello and welcome back to the How the Race Was Won podcast. I'm Dane Cash. I am joined, as ever, by Cosmo Catalano. Cosmo, how are you on this fine day?
I am well, Dane. Thank you.
We have so much to talk about after what was a very busy weekend of bike racing. And as I was out on my own ride this afternoon, I thought it's pretty much the perfect weekend for fans who are pretty serious about bike racing, because your non-cycling fans probably have, they've probably never heard of Tirreno Adriatico. You know, if they're completely, unversed in the world of bike racing, that's just not something they're going to know about. But
do you think they're going to know about Paris-Nice?
No, they're not. Paris-Nice, they're not going to know about Paris-Nice either. So it's not a, you know, you got to be pretty serious to really appreciate the racing. Yet, if you are a pretty serious fan, you're going to get two men's world tour races and a women's world tour race this weekend. So if you are willing to be a bit serious about bike racing and care about things beyond just the Tours de France, this is the weekend for you. And we're going to talk all about it on today's show. Before we do, I will tell you, dear listeners, that you should head on over to escapecollective.com/join if you haven't already, because I like making these podcasts. Pretty sure Cosmo likes making these podcasts. We want to keep doing it, and we need your support. So head on over to escapecollective.com/join so that you can hear us talk about bike racing, tell you how races were won. And like I said, today we got two big men's world tour races to talk about, Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico. There's also the Ronde van Drenthe on the women's side. We will talk a little bit about it, and then we will let Wheel Talk deep dive it the following day. Yeah, let's get to it. Let's get pretty serious. Let's tell people how races were won. Let's start with Paris-Nice. What's the headline? What's the big, what happened in a, you know, few seconds before we dive into how the race was won? What's your headline takeaway here?
Yeah, you know, Visma Elisa Bike does it again. Is Remco Evenepoel truly elite?
Yes.
Yeah, there's lots of little headlines, which is good, because I think this was definitely the more interesting of the two events. We had Matteo Jorgensen, that's with a J. There's video of him saying it when he's like 12, so I'm going to say that that's how you say it. He was very clever. He really kind of picked his moments well. We'll go into the details in a few minutes, but just, you know, gave himself a lead when other contenders were maybe not willing to take a risk. And then when those guys put their cards on the table, he was able to hold on and, yeah, got a pretty comfortable GC win, at least at the start of the final day, over another American, which is not too common. So uncommon, in fact, that the Paris Tour's Instagram account used four and then a quote, which most people in Europe would read as 4 seconds, and most Americans would read as 4 inches, which is maybe not the best localization, but also kind of funny. But yeah, it was cool. And, you know, Remco came in second, splitting him, looking good, but did he look good enough?
Yeah.
I'm sure the Belgian press will have opinions.
That is a great headline. Although given that we saw Jorgensen win the race and Brendan McNulty finish third, to me, the real headline of the weekend, even, because it, to me, this is the biggest thing that happened all weekend, even bigger than anything that happened at Tirreno. The headline is, "Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light," etc. Because basically, since September of last year, Americans are just dominating the men's world tour. And I want everyone to know about that, because it's been quite a long time since we've been able to.
The Americans have a big tour of Guangxi. I don't quite remember.
Nor do they have a big tour down under.
Okay.
Although our neighbors in Mexico had a fine tour down under. But I would say, if you talk about the big races people care about since September, the Vuelta and Paris-Nice they're up there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. If you want to be Eurocentric about it. Which,
yeah.
I don't know. Cycling.
Yeah.
Is there any cycling in Europe? Is that?
All right. How was the race won? Let's get into it.
I mean, we saw Remco doing Remco things pretty much from stage one. He was out making attacks, picking up some sprint points, I think some KOM points. We saw Olof Kooi take stage win. For my money, he's looking like the best sprinter so far. I have a variety of reasons for thinking that, but not super relevant right this second. Arvid Decline from Tudor, I think, got their first Pro Tour win on stage two and got to see Lawrence Pithy sneak into yellow for a day, which was cool. Then a team time trial. My apologies, Dane, but I will note they tried to – they zhuzhed it up with some drone shots a little bit, made it a little more exciting. There were some helmets that then became illegal the next day and some other helmets that are weird looking that are still legal but being investigated.
I think they have a month.
They have a month?
Yeah, okay. Anyway, continue.
Okay. After the TTT, we got American Brandon McNulty in yellow. He said after the race that Joao Almeida was their main rider. But they definitely, the next day, rode kind of defending McNulty's lead. Maybe Almeida wasn't feeling that great. He lost some time. Remco, again, was really doing this kind of feisty, kind of grabbing points. But Luke Plapp and Santiago Buitrago got away. Buitrago dropped Plapp, took the stage win. And that put Plapp into the yellow jersey. We had another Olaf Koy sprint win. And then stage six was really the queen stage. And it was a very classic-y queen stage. I think there were some snow closures. Basically, you had UAE kind of take over. It looked like they were going to winnow the field down. Then you had Trek come through, then Bora. And it basically left Remco isolated. We did see Roglic try to attack off the back of that Bora work. And he got a little bit of gap. And then we never really saw him again for the rest of the day. Yeah, Jorgensen kind of in the mix of this, snuck away from everyone else while Remco decided to mark other people. They got over the top of the climb, and then there was a bit of a crash, a little bit of disruption, and Skelmosa kind of snuck away, not in a like, oh, a crash, I'm going to attack kind of way, but in a there's a crash, people are kind of looking around wondering what's going to happen next, I'm going to go away. McNulty went with him. They teamed up with Jorgensen. Beautiful teamwork, just all the way to the line. Everybody knew what their plan was. Skelmosa took the stage win and then was like, no, I don't have any shot of winning this race. I'm not fit enough. Stage seven, we had the kind of sort of summit finish. We saw a lot of work by Sudal Quickstep, like 10 kilometers worth. It got the field down to 20, but really didn't do much damage to the big contenders. So Remco was kind of on his own, making these punchy attacks. Vlasov slipped away for the stage win. McNulty got gap by about 20 seconds, but then still managed to hold on to the lead with that four-second margin we talked about earlier. Today, stage eight, kind of a rolling circuit around Nice. McNulty just couldn't quite hold on with Remco. He was making these kind of punchy attacks. Jorgensen went with him, and the gap was very small at first. Only about 5 or 6 seconds. Vlasov bridged across. They hit a long descent into Nice, and then it just blew up. I don't know if that was equipment malfunction, like maybe it got stuck at 5 seconds. They came out of some clouds or out of a valley, and it was up to a minute. But that gap exploded, and the second group was just not there. Like, nobody really seemed to be able to rally for it. We saw, basically, Jorgensen still doing a little bit of work, but Remco doing most of it into the finish. Remco cut the stage. And Jorgensen with the overall. I'm going to probably have to say Jorgensen like 28,000 more times because I think I said Jorgensen every single time.
I think this is a blueprint for how to win and also make a race exciting, even if you are not a favorite in a race that had two very clear favorites coming in. One of those two did end up finishing second. Remco had a fine race. Is he elite? I don't know, but it was a fine race. The other one, I mean, if you're looking at over-heralded, under-heralded riders going into a race for a sports talk radio adjacent podcast, Roglic all the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah. If this is American sports talk, we're saying, how are we going to get rid of this guy before the trade deadline?
How?
Right? Like, we got...
Yeah, just cut him.
We got the ultimate shade in broadcast today. Sean Kelly was like, oh, you know, carrying a few extra pounds. Like, very, very much... looked out of shape in a variety of ways, still didn't look bad. Like, there were a lot of times where he was hanging in with the leaders like it was no big deal on some of the bigger climbs in the race. But he definitely didn't look like a guy who'd shown up here with victory on his mind. And, you know, credit to Bora. I don't know if it was – maybe that was the plan. This is to get Roglic in shape and let Vlasov take some shots. Vlasov's looked really good all season. Looked really good, even if he couldn't quite hold up with Remco and Jorgensen on this last stage. Like, active guy, looks fit, definitely maybe some Grand Tour stage wins in his future. But yeah, I feel like Roglic may not be the man at Bora this year. Or maybe he's just looking for the Vuelta. I don't know.
That's a sports talk radio take right there. If he's not the man for Bora, does that mean that Vlasov is?
I was thinking Jai Hindley. He was looking pretty good at the other race. So.
Yeah. Well, we got a comment. Question, which this dovetails into perfectly, Colby asking what's going on with Roglic. Is he starting the season slower for, I think he's asking for the Tour peak. to me, I'm not worried about Roglic. I think this is him not caring so much about anything other than the Tour this year. He's at the point in his career where he needs the Tour. That's really all he's going to care about at this point. He's 34. He's, you know, getting into that twilight of his career territory. I can say that because I'm 35 now, so I can call him old. and I think if you're Roglic, all you care about is how can I best get into the best shape for the Tour de France. And so in years past, he has been really good early in the season. Several times we've seen him do quite well at Paris-Nice. I don't think he's worried about it. And I'm not worried about him either. I don't think that Hindley is the guy for this team. I don't think that Vlasov is. I just think he's going to be taking a different buildup this year.
What's his contract term? Do we know how long
he's
there
on
for?
A two-year deal at Bora.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, you know, this is a two-year game plan. Maybe he's getting in, he feels comfortable. They're on board with what his schedule is, what his training is, if he's going to ramp up slow. Because, I mean, last year we saw him almost like a robot kind of doing Roglic wins, you know, in these uphill finishes where it was sort of a small sprint, kind of sitting in and then being just stronger than everyone. Although that was Tirreno last year.
But he was also building up to the Giro.
Yeah.
And, you know, this year.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Different.
Good point.
That said, overheralded for sure coming into the race, obviously. I mean, he was heralded as the guy to beat with Evenepoel, and he was nowhere to be seen, really. What else? I mean, first of all, what does it all mean? I mean, is Mateo Jorgensen now, is he going to win the next Grand Tour for Visma? I think yes. Sure.
I don't know about that part. I don't think there was any question that he was this was a leadership role for him. This was going to be his race. And I think he rode really well. I think he got good team support from a squad that wasn't super focused on, you know, planting their flag on this race. But, you know, it's Visma. They're a top tier team. They get everything together. I think there was a recent interview he did with Kaylee where he's like, oh, here is the long, long list of things that I don't have to worry about because I'm on this team. And so, like, yeah, I think you can maybe see a lot of that where, like, you know, he in the race interview after the race, he talked about, like, feeling the pressure. He talked about, you know, maybe being restless, having a restless night's sleep before the race today. But he wasn't talking about, like, where is my jacket after the stage? Like, how am I going to get to my next altitude camp after this event? He very much seemed like a guy who was 100% focused on his race, knew what he had to do, just had to hit his marks and did. I don't think that necessarily makes him, you know, their next Grand Tour contender, but I think, you know, riding the way he did, especially I think today was really kind of the toughest stage because no one else was able to go with Remco. And there weren't a ton of people who really needed to, obviously McNulty. But you know, this was a guy who was instrumental in their Umloop win. This is a guy who's probably going to be there in the Hilly Classics too. And maybe he is a guy who wins the race. Maybe he's a guy who sets up the win. And I think that same thing could apply at the Dauphiné. I don't know, Tour of Pologne if he ends up there. But yeah, it's cool to see a rider who's obviously had some ability. We saw him at Movistar basically trying everything last year and getting these kind of top tens just outside the podium. He'll get up the road towards the end of the race but can't get clear. Kind of come through with this big win in addition to being a very helpful domestique.
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, to the point of you mentioned Jorgensen talked to Kaylee, and he talked to Kaylee like right before. So I think that's the form. Do you talk to Kaylee? Talk to
Escape Collective. Can we read this article somewhere, Dane?
And then you can go
win. Is this article on the internet?
It is. It's on the interwebs at escapecollective.com. And I think it's just a sign that you should talk to Kaylee or really any Escape Collective journalist before you want to go win a race, because 100% of the time it works. The other thing, I think with Jorgensen, I was pretty surprised with his climbing in this race. The last day had a lot of up and down. I mean, just a lot of accumulated climbing on that final stage. This was not a race win that came about because his team had an awesome team time trial and then put him into position with, you know, a big attack. This was a well-earned, like, yes, the strategy was there, that the attack that he joined with Skelmoza and McNulty was decisive. But
technically, they joined him.
There we go, yeah. But he also then defended, you know, his position in the GC with Remco Evenepoel. The guy whose engine is big enough that In a race of truth against the whole planet, he is the fastest one, according to the last time this happened. So it's pretty good. for Jorgensen to be able to do this. And it's, I think it confirmed that this is not just great tactics from his team. It's also a big part of it is how fit he was. And the ability to climb as well as he did, to me, that speaks really highly of what's maybe to come for him. I don't really think we have a great sense of what is this, like, the ceiling for him, because I think he is young enough and has continued to evolve quickly enough and grow as a rider quickly enough that I think it's kind of hard to say where he ends up. I was being facetious when I said he was going to win the next Grand Tour for this team, but, you know, being a...
I mean, don't rule it out, right?
Yeah, I mean, being a Grand Tour type rider is not... That doesn't seem impossible. Nothing seems impossible after Sepp Kuss won the Vuelta. You know, Americans winning all Grand Tours, monuments, and the World Championships is now possible in my book. But the sky's the limit for him.
Can we go back to Remco being the fastest man in the Race of Truth thing? Because I agree, he's done that. He can do that. That isn't really what bike racing is like. That's why the Race of Truth is the Race of Truth, and the rest of bike racing is mostly not that. He actually showed what I thought were a lot of like strong kind of race management skills.
Yeah,
his team, he really, you know what he needs is Matteo Jorgensen on his team. He's got like 80% of what he needs. He's got guys that can haul the mail, that can cover attacks. But he was isolated a lot of the time and really kind of had to pick who he was going to follow, when he was going to attack. And, you know, he was super effective when he made his efforts. He was, I thought, pretty smart in planning what he was going to do. He won the points competition and the climbing, the KOM competition. So, like, clearly has a huge range of ability. I just, comparing him to Vinyga, who we'll talk about in a second, I think he is not, I don't know if it's him personally, Remco, who can't execute like that, or maybe his team, or maybe a combination of both. But I am still, if I'm Remco, worried about how I'm going to answer statements like Vinyga might make in a Grand Tour.
Yeah, I think this is a very promising sign for Remco, who in the past has done things that were less smart. Like the way that he has ridden in the past, strategically, there have been some question marks because he just seemed to just attack all the time. And it was like, dude, stop. you're not achieving anything.
Well, so I thought that on stage one, and as kind of the race went on, as we saw how close it was coming with bonus seconds, and as we saw those other competitions, it's sort of like, oh, you know, if this is a minimal effort for him to pick up this point, this sprint, pick up this KOM on stage one, and that gets him 10,000 euros more prize money,
oh, yeah,
or something that hedges bets if he has a bad day, like, that's smart racing. Like, we need to remember, stage races are just elongated one days. Like, there's all sorts of different things you can do and all sorts of different ways things can go wrong. And having something to fall back to isn't necessarily a bad idea.
Yeah, I think he had a great race. I think the expectation was that if Roglic wasn't going to be there, and first of all, we should say Roglic, he finished 10th. It's not like he wasn't there. I should be nicer. But if Roglic wasn't going to really contend for the win, I think the expectation was that Remco was going to run away with it. And he didn't. So that might have been disappointing.
Okay, yeah.
But he won a stage two jerseys. I mean, he had a heck of a...
He was good. He looked great. I don't think there's anything that looked worse than I expected about Remco.
Yeah.
Definitely looked better than I expected. I still have the questions I've always had.
Yeah, I think he got outfoxed by tactically by, you know, the attack that went clear and his own team's inability to really do much about it. But yeah, we saw really good riding from Remco and from Matteo Jorgensen, and hats off to them. Well, maybe the last point I would say is that I'm a little bit surprised that Jorgensen is the one winning a stage race of this caliber before McNulty, because I think McNulty coming up was the one that I expected to do that earlier. And I think he was the one that I expected to be a stage racing, more complete all-rounder earlier. And so far in his career, the climbing has been a question mark. His time trialing has been pretty good. But he did do a darn good job to at least finish on the podium. So, yeah, it's impressive from both of them.
Yeah, I was going to say, he is that situation you mentioned earlier where a guy has a good TTT and ends up in the lead. Like, that's sort of what happened to McNulty, right? He was a little sick at UAE. He talked about that in one of the race post-races. He said he wasn't really their GC guy and kind of found himself there and just had to step up and do it. And I agree completely. I think he did a really good job stepping into a tough role, not at 100%, and doing the best he could.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, all right. There's Paris-Nice. Hats off to Matteo Jorgensen, Remco. By the way, Egan Bernal finished 7th overall. He got dropped on some of the tougher climbs, but he, again, really, we keep saying this, but it continues to show that he is getting better and better, coming back. I love to see that. So that's Paris-Nice. Let's take a quick break. All right, well, that's half of how the men's World Tour races were won so far this weekend. But there's a whole other men's World Tour event that happened last week. Tirreno Adriatico, the race from the Tyrrhenian to the Adriatic Sea in Italy. Cosmo, what's the big headline here?
Simple fisherman's son earns Trident of Neptune, obviously.
That is excellent. Bravo.
Thank you.
I'm thinking you can maybe get a little more aggressive with how destructive he. I think he laid waste to the
competition. Yeah, he was super strong.
The words that came to mind. And then the other big takeaway from this whole week, the big headline was that Jonathan Milan is really emerging as a sprinter to watch. Johnny Long wrote a great story over the last week about sprinting in the World Tour. Somebody coined this term, the Republic of Sprinters, right now, which is a reference to the fact that it's a very wide open sprint field. As good as Jasper Philipsen won as last year's tour, he just seems like one of several very good riders right now. Olaf Koy, who you mentioned at Paris-Nice, looks like another really darn good one. And Philipsen was at Tirreno, and he looked good, but he wasn't the best sprinter there. I think Jonathan Milan was the best sprinter there. And to me, that's the other headline. It's that Milan is, you know, he's at least campaigning for president in the Republican sprinters.
Well, the election's coming up on this weekend, so.
Maybe the election's coming up in July. I feel like that's when we maybe crown the, you know.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sanremo used to be, but no, but sprinters, they have a hard time.
We'll see what happens this year.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
All right, we'll get to that in a bit. But let's talk Tirreno. How was the race won?
Yeah, I think a much more traditional early season stage race here. First stage time trial, Ayuso nipping Ghana, which is cool. Vinigo, a maybe surprising 22 seconds down. Obviously not his forte as far as TTs go, but still I think he'd prefer to be a little closer given the margins ahead of him.
Probably trying to get used to the helmet. It's not easy.
Yeah. This helmet is a duck. This is something they put up there so the UCI could say, no, this is too weird. And the actually good helmet is going to come out right before the tour. And his position is already optimized for that.
Excellent.
So that's, They're like, this helmet's really good, but we're just going to get banned. Let's get a weird looking helmet out there.
And cross
it out. I mean, I would 100% do this if I were some sort of brand making aerodynamic stuff dealing with the UCI.
Yeah.
Just make it look less weird.
Maybe that's, I don't know, we'll have to call Giro. Anyway.
Stage two, typical Italian kind of early sprint day. Philipsen won. Stage three, similar. There was a bit of a late climb. Phil Bauhaus came through. Stage four, I thought, was the most entertaining sprint of the race. It was, you ended up a situation where Uno X had put out a late attacker. This almost seems to be their new leadout strategy. And we ended up with Tom Pidcock, and he's on the front. He really doesn't want to be on the front and just does not, you know, he doesn't have a bag of tricks to kind of get off the front. If you watch this, if you find the footage, go track it down, watch this. It's a great example of how much patience there can be in being an effective group sprinter. Because this, you know, this looked like in a matter of 3 minutes, it was going to be a solo win. It was going to be a reduced sprint win between Binyam Girmay and Pidcock and other guys who are quick but not super fast sprinters. And then all of a sudden, it was a group sprint and Jonathan Milan came through. And it really on paper, it was just a sprint. But like watching the video, you really get the sense of all the stuff that can go on in those final kilometers, regardless of what the profile looks like.
Definitely.
Stage five was the first mountain day. Not a hilltop finish. Still some big climbs. We saw Visma Lisa Bike going to do their thing around 35K to go. 28K to go. Vinigo attacks. Pidcock is not in great position. We saw Jai Hindley and O'Connor give it a shot, try to stay on his wheel. Not able to do it. I think the top of the climb was 23K to go. Vinigo had about a minute at the top of it, and they lost a little bit on the descent. I think it was... I think it was Del Toro, right, leading the group back down the mountain. I think they gained about 10 seconds. But as soon as they hit the flat again, wasn't great cooperation in the group. Vinigo got another 10, 20 seconds. That put him into the lead. Pidcock actually ended up not even in the second group. Stage six, uphill finish. I think we all know how this is going to end. We did see Bora take up the mantle of leadership, which is cool. Hindley gave it a shot. Ayuso and Vinigo went with them, and then Vinigo was like, okay, now I'm gonna do this, and just took off 6K to go. And yeah, you know, rode it in solo, dominant, super convincing win. Last day, we saw Jonathan Nulon with another kind of Uno X late attack. Again, very patient, kind of waiting for the sprint to unfold. I was cheering so hard for Alexander Kristoff because he's got to be 15 years older than every other guy in the sprint. And you can watch him like figuring out how the sprint is going to go. You could see him kind of get bumped a little bit, and then he's in the wind and he's like, it's still 300 some odd meters to go. But he's like, you know what? That is a distance I stack up well against these guys. And really, like, put on a good fight. Milan won.
It was close.
It was close. Milan, I think at the line, Milan was pretty comfortable. But, like, you were watching it head on. You were like, oh, man, is he going to pull it off? And then just last little bit, I think Kristoff ran out of gas. But, yeah, it was a cool sprint. Not as cool as four. But, you know, big picture, it was Vinigo doing what you expect a Grand Tour winner to do in one of these tune-up races and doing it with style.
Yeah, I felt like... a couple things. So in terms of the GC battle, I thought that the day that he really stormed into the lead, Visma did a great job of teeing him up. I mean, they were giving him a lead out, basically. It was like, he's going to attack at this point, and we're going to lead him out to that spot, and he was in perfect position to do it, and then he launched. So I think if you're another team, you're in a really hard position trying to do anything about that, regardless of the fact that it's Jonas Vingegaard, and then it's Jonas Vingegaard doing it. But yeah, we've seen teams, you know, put in this huge turn of pace on a climb for, you know, 20 years now. And I think there's a lot of criticism, you know, for Sky for doing that, putting their train on the front and just wearing everybody out.
Criticism for winning the race, for riding.
Yeah, exactly.
Effective
criticism because they won.
Getting to the goal
completely
effectively.
That said, it is more entertaining when at least that does then lead to somebody firing off the front. It's not like you grind them down there's no attacks. They grind them down and then Vingegaard just like destroys everybody. That's a little bit more fun to watch.
Yes, I agree. And I mean, I thought Juan Ayuso did a great job. I think there were some guys who are at Paris-Nice that maybe could have been at Torino for him. And I thought he was really good. I thought he did a really good job keeping where he needed to be in the group, being in a position where he could at least attempt to match Vinigo. I thought he rode really smartly with Hindley. Like they both, you know, it's a classic situation where you have to collaborate with someone you are going to eventually stab in the back. And so there's a lot of nuance, a lot of detente there. And I thought Ayuso looked really good. I thought he was very, very confident that he could take Hindley in these sprints for bonus seconds kind of at the end of these stages. But also like not overinvest getting to that point where he could use his finishing kick a little bit. I've always thought he looks awesome, but
I personally sort of felt that Hindley and Bora settled. And I think the chances of them actually being able to beat Vingegaard are very slim. But I think they accepted that those chances were zero with the way that they rode. Because if your strategy is to quote-unquote put Vingegaard under pressure by hitting the front, like that's just not going to happen. And I think the only potential way that you have to overhaul Vingegaard in this race is to actually try to attack from a little farther out rather than setting the pace. Like that's what Visma is going to do. I think you got to do something different. And it, you know, hats off to them for putting a guy on the podium for him. You know, Hindley looked pretty good. But to me, it sort of seemed like there was this like acceptance of, well, we're not going to win. So, you know, either that or they really thought they could drop Vingegaard by setting a hard pace on a climb, which doesn't particularly seem that wise to me.
I mean, the 3D chess move here, right, is for Bora and UAE to get together and say, how are we going to beat Vingegaard?
Totally.
Right? Because Del Toro, like I know I just said UAE maybe could have had a stronger team. Del Toro was
awesome.
Outstanding.
Absolutely.
And he's close enough to the top of the GC
Yep.
that they probably could have sent him up the road. on some early climbs, early in the stage. Would have been a fight, but if he's up the road, that changes everything, right? Then everyone else can sit on their butts and be like, all right, Visma, show us how it's done. And it's, you know, this was basically how then Jumbo beat Pogacar.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's, I mean, the plan is there. I just think you would need that collusion, which is nominally
even then,
against
the
rules. The
likelihood of it working is low. Yeah. But it's at least, I think, more likely to work than what they did. And I will say that I think Vingegaard here at this race, what he did with his destructive move when he took the lead, to me, felt sort of similar to, or at least the impact of it, similar to what you might feel if you're the rest of the peloton at Strade, where this move happens that you can do absolutely nothing about. This rider gets a winning margin that you pretty much have no chance of overcoming. And the fact that he did it, the fact that he really put the hammer down on that climb, I think it makes it easier for him in the future, much like when Pogacar does these crazy attacks, it helps build that aura of inevitability that we were discussing last week with Trudit, where you do this enough times, then you sort of just kind of, you put the fear into your rivals so that they do just accept their lot at second or third or whatever. And I think it really helps Vingegaard and Pogacar whenever they do this in the future, that they have already done this in the past, when riders can look back and say, okay, well, I remember that last time that Vingegaard just destroyed everybody. So at this point, there's not even a chance for us.
No, I'm totally with you. And I want to cheer up the rest of the peloton by pointing out, like, yeah, these looked super dominant on paper, on video, however you look at them. But then you know, go by the numbers. Like, the 6K attack that Vingegaard made was, you know, he was out there going as hard as he'd go for about 16 minutes, and he gained 26 seconds over the next competitor. That's a winning gap. That's big. But that's not, like, aura of invincibility huge. And, you know, the margin he took on the previous stage was bigger, but it was an even shorter. You know, it was like a 10-minute effort. It is not the sort of effort you're going to see at the Tour de France. And so, you know, I have a bone to pick with the internet sometimes when people are like, oh my God, it was this many watts per kilo. Like, that's unheard of. And it's sort of like, well, you're comparing watts per kilo, you know, 5 days in Torino for 10 minutes to 20 days in the Tour de France for half an hour, an hour. And you don't actually know how many kilos he weighs. You can make anything seem superhuman and invincible, or you can look at the numbers you have and say, you know, how do I lose, what, 6 divided by 25, like 5 fewer seconds, like per K? Like, it's not outside the realm of possibility. And it's just, you know, it can be done. I think it's going to take some bad days. I think Vingegaard looks really, really good. And I think he and his team both have a history of executing almost to perfection, as long as they're not changing bikes on the cobbles of the day. It's going to take some doing, but it is possible to do.
Cosmo Catalano chiseling away at the aura here.
So you have to do it. That's
somebody's got to do it.
Can't eat an elephant one bite, Dan.
Yeah.
That's
a nice proverb. I felt like there's some heralding that needs to be done here. You mentioned it when you were describing how this race was won, but I would like to do a little bit of extra heralding of the entire Uno X team, because they, a week from now, people who didn't watch this race, if they just like go check the results, they're not going to know that Uno X came so close on a couple of occasions. They're not going to know that they helped animate the race. And you kind of, I love the way you describe what they did on, it was kind of on two different stages. They like kind of, their new lead outs, their lead out strategy is sort of this, it's a new thing that I think it like kind of really could work, almost worked.
Yeah. Especially with Christoph.
Yeah. The last stage where Søren Wærenskiold got off the front, surprisingly, with like, I don't know, maybe 600 meters to go. And Jonathan Milan was looking around because he knew he didn't want to close the gap. He didn't want to waste the energy to close the gap. And that meant that Wærenskiold was up the road up until maybe 200 meters to go. He still had a gap. So on the one hand, he might win. And then on the other hand, if you're Alexander Kristoff, you just slot in right behind everybody else. They have to do the work. You're getting let out by people that aren't on your team. it were, I mean, if he were maybe a younger man in his prime, I could see that having won. I could see him having won this stage.
I mean, this is like dream scenario for Kristoff is all the lead out people are gone. There's a bunch of sprinters trying not to look around at each other because they know they can't sprint the full distance. And then Kristoff, you know, launching this big, long sprint when they're still trying to decide what to do.
It could have worked. So hats off, unheralded riders, Søren Werenskiold, obviously Alexander Kristoff. And who was it the earlier stage that finished? He still ended up finishing, what was it, seventh, I think, on stage four. Like, got caught close to the line, still had enough strength to finish seventh on the day. That was...
I thought he was going to win that for a lot of it.
Yeah, it looked close.
Man, they're really messing around
here.
That was
Jonas Abrahamsson, really close to winning on stage four. That was impressive. On both accounts, Jonathan Milan dashing the hopes of the Uno X team. But nice job, Uno X, for animating the race on sprint days. You know, they made them quite entertaining. And yeah, I think Milan it really deserves to get credit for, particularly on the last stage, a couple things. One, he had the presence of mind to know not to close the gap himself. He had the presence of mind to look around, spot that his teammate was right behind it coming up and was going to be able to get there in time. Hats off to Simone Consone, total unheralded. I mean, really, really nice job in that lead out to get up there in time to pull everybody back up. But then Milan, I think he showed pretty clearly to me in that moment, at least on Sunday's final stage, he was definitely faster than Jasper Philipsen. I thought he looked significantly stronger, regardless of all the other strategy, the positioning, all that stuff. If you just pure speed, I think he also just looks stronger, and it's not easy to be faster than Jasper Philipsen in a sprint.
I thought Philipsen looked a little flat for a lot of this race, but also there wasn't a Vanderpool leading him out. I don't know what his season objectives are, whether he's going to try and win every stage of the Tour de France, whether he's going to try to do the classics. He was second at Roubaix last year. Like, we can't forget that.
I do think he is.
Yeah.
I do think he is eyeing the classics. Hats off to Milan for showing that he is, he's campaigning. Him and Olaf Koy, I feel like they're really going head to head in a two-party sprinter republic system. They look to me like the two candidates right now, with Philipsen maybe.
The problem Koy has is the entire rest of his team.
That is true.
Not that they're bad, but they're focused on something else completely.
Yeah, they're too good. Yeah, all right. We did have some good questions here from Discord, and I wanted to get to two of them. First, let's try to answer a question that I don't think either of us can answer, but it's a good question at least, which is, which of these races is a better training block? Or maybe, is it just better not to go to these races for the classics? That was Martin Heaton asked that question. And
we'll find out. Matthew will let us know this spring.
So I was a little surprised. First of all, again, I don't think we can answer this question. I just don't think we know. But when I did some digging to figure out, all right, well, which classic stars have done which in the last few years? And Vanderpool has done a sort of a mix in his various times of being a star in the classics, and so have a couple of other of the successful riders, or they just haven't done either one of them. So the takeaway for me was that doing Tirreno or doing neither of them tended to present better results than I expected, because my expectation was that I was going to dig and find that Paris-Nice was the clear winner. I think maybe there was a history of people doing Paris-Nice. The classics guys maybe doing Paris-Nice a bit more. Maybe my mind is just thinking of Sean Kelly. And obviously the weather tends to be, you know, you start in Paris, the weather's all bad. And that maybe that helps you prepare for the classics. So I was expecting going into this that I was going to see Paris-Nice had the edge. But I think they both seem to be pretty good preparation races. And going to altitude, just doing your own camp, whatever, it's pretty popular these days. So that also, I think, works. I think any of them could work, I guess, is what we're trying to say here.
I mean, I've seen plenty of Tirreno Adriaticos.
We had that this year too.
Tirreno. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I think this would almost be a better performance process podcast question.
Yeah.
Because sorry, performance process.
Process.
Podcast question. Yeah, I do not claim to know a ton about training. In my experience, stuff can be super personal. One guy could have a great time on a hilly, just, you know, almost like a series of classics stage race, which occasionally Toronto, actually both of these races have experimented a little bit with how they do things. And other people just want to sit in the pack and pedal and try not to get dropped and just get the, you know, kind of stable, fast, hard racing in without that explosiveness and that craziness. And I think it would vary from my perspective, it would vary a ton. I think in terms of being the better race, I don't know how you don't say it was Paris-Nice this year. I thought it was a really good race. I am also, you know, someone who likes the weirdness of cycling, the intricacies that a stage race brings, where a sprint on stage one has relevance in the GC on stage eight. But yeah, it is an interesting question, and I think, you know, we'll see how Vanderpool does when he gets back into the peloton this spring.
Let's talk which is a better race, because that was, you know, that was a question we got specifically, just, you know, which is better. John H. asked that. And then a sort of a wrinkle in that is from Antonello: which one is more pleasing to follow in loco, which I believe is on location. I've never been to either one, so I can't answer that. Maybe somebody can tell us in the Discord, if they've been to both, how do they compare?
Yeah.
But yeah, I've never been to either one, actually, so I can't answer that. I can say that I think which one is better kind of depends on what you're looking for. I think Paris-Nice is a more entertaining race, as you said, for riders, for people who like the weird stuff. I think in general, especially in the last few years, Paris-Nice has been designed in such a way that it is a bit more entertaining. Tirreno, certainly the last few years, has been the one that has been a bit more traditional as a stage race. It's the one that looks more like a mini Grand Tour. And I think if you look at the winners, the top 10s in general, you see that as well. I mean, obviously the guy that won the Tour de France just won Tirreno, so that's kind of a no-brainer. Yeah, it kind of depends what you're looking for.
Isn't the Tour ending in Nice this year?
Yes.
Yeah, so obviously you can't go now. The race is over. But I think this finale in Nice may have had particular significance. Maybe you could see kind of the setup and the planning for what they're doing for the Tour de France kind of underway at the end of this race.
I would think that of all the things that you might want to do another race to recon something later in the year, like, oh, I'll do Paris-Roubaix to recon the Roubaix cobbles because they're in the Tour this year or something like that. I would think the seafront on the French Riviera would not be something you'd really need to recon to get a sense of it. I don't know that.
It's maybe kind of a rocky beach there.
It's a very rocky beach.
It's the cobbles of beaches.
It really is true. The beach itself, very rocky. The road, you know.
Yeah.
But good point. Any final takeaways from Tirreno Adriatico?
No. I still don't think Pidcock looks like a guy who's ready to win a Grand Tour.
Oof, man. The commentators are going to – yeah. I agree with you.
Again, maybe he's just saying that so that people don't pick up on, like, his mountain bike agenda. I don't know.
Maybe. Or maybe he's doing the Primoz Roglic where all that really matters to him is the Tour, you know.
Again, he was just so – he looks about what he looked like in Tour de Suisse last year. And it's like, okay, you're pretty good at this, but like, you're so good at mountain biking.
Right,
man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Or even just – you're so good at races like Amstel. Like that
– true, yeah.
Yeah, that is something that – yeah, I don't know. Or maybe Flanders in the future. I mean, Timon Arensman was the best placed rider from Ineos, finished sixth. He looked pretty good.
He looked great.
Yeah. Pidcock was ninth. Just not quite there yet, but maybe it's coming. Maybe that time is coming. All right, let's take a quick break. All right, that's the two men's races that happened, men's World Tour races that happened this weekend. There was a women's World Tour race that happened this week, a big one, the Ronde van Drenthe. We'll talk in 24 hours' time. We'll give you the full rundown. But Cosmo, what's the headlines coming out of the race? What was your big takeaway?
Estee Works doing Estee Works things. Lorena Rebus winning number four. Course races a lot better without snow closures. I am really excited to hear what Abby can get from riders who are actually in the peloton, because it was the roads are so narrow, kind of leading into the final climb. A lot of pushing and shoving, a lot of jockeying. I really want to hear the stories from the inside. Kind of go with what I saw today.
I think that Wiebes, her ability to be as powerful as she is on a climb that is not insignificant. I mean,
she's calling her a sprinter is a little limiting.
I think exactly that is what I'm getting at. She's more than that. It's a short but pretty steep finish on the Vanberg, and you know, hats off to her and her team for getting it right, not once, not twice, not thrice, but now four times in a row, which is the consistency is really, really impressive, and it's just so hard to do something like that four times in a row. Yeah, Wheel Talk has more that'll be out tomorrow, so check on that. Listen to their insight. Odds and ends from the cycling world. Well, we got a monument coming up. It's Milan-San Remo, the first of the year. I'm really looking forward to the final half an hour, as ever. Can't wait.
Dane, no. You have to go. It's like a multi-course meal, and you're here for the dessert. Come on, man. Come on.
It would be
not
one,
even the dessert. You want the after-dinner drink. You want the little cup of limoncello instead.
If I lived in New England and I didn't have to get up when I would have to get up for that limoncello, fine. But being in Colorado means I got to get up pretty darn early for that, you know, that aperitivo. And I kind of just want that main course, you know? And it's a great main course. It's a really great main course that we're going to get when the Peloton hits the Poggio. But yeah, they have made some
after dinner drink, Dan. I'm saying the sprint is the limoncello.
Oh, I see.
So you're
okay.
Working your way. You are like, I can't wait for the limoncello. And I'm saying, like, the reason limoncello tastes so good is because you had this great dessert. And before that, you had this great main course. And before that, you had this awesome salad. And then this outstanding appetizer.
Sure.
And then before that, you had a Strega. How's that?
All right. Some minor changes to the route. But the finale is going to be the same. Trey Cappie, the Gypress of the Poggio. It's probably going to be a showdown between the small group that makes it over the Poggio together. We've seen a shift away from the Sprinters Classic that this once was. Your favorites include Tadej Pogacar. He sure looked good at the other Italian one day he just raced. Who else? We've got Matthew Vanderpool. He's done a couple of Milan San Remos in the past. He's a pretty good rider. Mats Pedersen, I think, could be the most likely to challenge them. Or I think that the real, to me, the one that I would put my money on is Christophe Laporte. He has the leadership of the team that has won basically everything. And Wout van Aert has decided to skip this race. And Christophe Laporte sure can finish fast, but he's also shown recently that he can get over some climbs. Yeah, I think he's a really, really strong candidate here, even against the likes of Pogacar and Vanderpool.
I will note that not only has Robbie McEwen claimed that it's going to be a sprint this year, but he has claimed that Jonathan Milan is the top candidate.
I think
to take that.
I mean, honestly, I would love to see a sprint at Milan-San Remo because I think it makes it that much better when there really is a sense that a sprint could happen. And we've seen it not happen for so long that it's starting to get away from that. So I think having one every few years is good for the race. So if Jonathan Milan can come away as the winner, then I'm entertained, and I think it helps the race in the future. And it makes Robbie McEwen look smart, too. All right, that's it for...
Robbie McEwen with a zero San Remo wins. Just going
to... Yeah, does that mean that his analysis is...
I don't know. He's failed to win the race. He was close a couple of times, but I don't think he ever...
If a lack of San Remo wins or of any major bike race wins disqualifies you from giving good analysis, we may be in trouble. That may be a problem.
Fair point.
All right, that's us. That's us for this week. I hope you enjoyed as we got pretty serious on a weekend that I think really rewards those who are very, very, very serious about bike racing. Milan-San Remo's coming up. Can't wait for that, and we'll be back. In the meantime, you'll have Wheel Talk, Placeholders, Geek Warning, Performance Process, and then we'll be back. I'm Dane Cash, and I don't know, who are you? What is this show?
I'm Cosmo Catalano, and that was the How the Race Was Won podcast.